Well, welcome everyone to Live from My Drum Room. I have a very special show today with my dear friend, David Wasikinen, drummer for the Hooters, an old friend going back, we realized, 35 years this year, and we'll talk about that. We're going to talk about David's long tenure with the band, the Hooters, going back to 1980, and also talk about a side project or a project that he has called In the Pocket, which is very exciting and interesting to me, and I think it will be to you as well. All the great music that came out of Philadelphia, which is his hometown, and we're going to play some of that music as well. It's going to be a great show. He's got a lot of energy, this guy. He's a great drummer, a great friend, and I'm really, really excited to bring him on the show. So please welcome, without further ado, David Wasikinen.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm great, buddy. Good to see you, David.
Great to see you as well.
Thanks for taking some time out of your Sunday, buddy. Thank you.
Kind of walking around like everybody else, daylight saving time.
Yes. We were just talking about that, yeah.
Yikes. You know, I turned 68 a couple weeks ago, and, you know, like every bit of daylight I get, I'm happy with now. Give me another hour, man. Let's go to three hours behind you.
Right. I know, but I was just, it's funny how I think as we get older, like losing that hour, it's a lot harder to sort of bounce back.
Yeah. You know? You're right about that, but I do appreciate it. I really like, you know, I spent my band's getting ready to go to Europe in June. We do it like every year. We spend, you know, at least 6 weeks over there. And most of the places we play, the sun doesn't go down. You know, it's like, you know, you have to close the curtains to get to sleep. You know, you open the curtains at 3 a.m., 2 a.m. It's still looks like 3 in the afternoon, you know. So
that's wild, man. Yeah.
It is wild. You know, they're my people, the Finns, you know. But
crazy bunch, those Finnish people. Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, we took a cruise. It would have been now, I guess, 2015. We took one of those, a Viking Sea cruise into the Baltic, throughout the Baltic region. And so it was in June. And I remember exactly what you said. It was like 2 a.m. We'd look out the window, our cabin in our boat, and it would be light out. It was the freakiest thing. But we were excited to see that. We knew that would be the case. We're like, wow, this is incredible. So
indeed. Yeah. That was a crazy thing. I used to go there when I was a kid. The first time I went to Finland, I was 11 years old, and it was the summer, and it just didn't get dark at all, you know? And I had some crazy relatives, man. They're sauna, beer, and sunshine, you know?
Oh, man.
So, but I love it. I love
it. Yeah, man. Yeah. And that's great to hear some family background. Born and raised, though, in Philly, right? Were you actually born in Philly?
Yeah, I was.
Or outside?
First generation American. My parents came over. My dad somehow ended up, you know, I was like thinking about that one day, you know, because he came over to New York City, and I think he got a job as a dishwasher or something and worked in a soap factory. And then he was building houses for Levitt in around early 1950s. And then sent for my mom. They got married in Finland a year later, came over, and I was born. And, you know, I'm really happy to be like living in the time that I lived, you know, getting experience. The Beatles and all that kind of stuff, you know. Unfortunately, those 60s were pretty turbulent, but that whole idea of being able to see the Beatles and the Stones on TV when you were, I don't know, probably 9, 10 years old when they were on the Ed Sullivan Show. And it was just like, boom, like for everyone else, you know, that like, what just hit us, you know?
Well, I remember us talking about this a long time, telling me how affected you were by the Beatles. And I made a note of that, in fact. And I was going to ask you if you remembered about how old you were when you saw them. So you think really young. And would you say that was the spark that made you want to play music, play the drums?
Yeah. Well, that was one of them. My dad, who isn't a musician, but he loved music in Finland. He would always go see, you know, anytime a jazz artist, Duke Ellington or Count Basie or Harry James or anybody like that came over, he would try to see them. So there was a place near where we grew up called the Lambertville Music Circus. So, he, you know, when I was a kid, he would drag me out to, you know, bring me out to shows, you know, and like Count Basie, all those artists I mentioned. Yeah. And so I, you know, I was familiar with that and he loved it. I can tell you once he wanted to take me to see Duke Ellington. And I said, no, I want to go build a fort. You know, like a kid. I look back, go, what? But that was my first, you know, that, and then seeing the Beatles, it just, I still, you know, I remember I had the flu. I had a really high fever. My mom said it was like 102 or something like that. Boy. Room was spinning, but you know, I still remember like it stopped, you know, and I'm not even sure if we had a color TV then, but I just remember thinking everything turned to color.
Wow. Yeah.
See the Beatles,
yeah,
man. And I remember my mom went and bought a little record player, and then, I think we had something. My dad was listening to records on, but I remember her buying this portable record player that we sat on a table, and we would listen to that 45 over and over again. Me and my two sisters, two younger sisters, and you know, we were just knocked out by it, as my parents were. My mom was like over the moon over the Beatles, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it moved me to. You know, and I remember I started pestering my dad. I don't even know, like, just wanted to play an instrument. You know, I wanted to do that. And I had a friend of mine who moved in the neighborhood that had a guitar. And, you know, and there was a snare drum on a stand with a little cymbal over there. I went over, he could play What I Say on guitar. And I think Wipeout. And I got the drums, and I could play a beat. Boom. I started playing that beat. I became the drummer then, and I've been the drummer since, you know.
Wow, man.
Just
yeah.
That kind of thing, you know.
But no lessons. So you just self-taught, just.
Well, no, but I took lessons later. You know, once I got in school, you know, they offered some lessons with, I actually picked up a trumpet first. My parents, because my dad loved Harry James. So you're going to play the trumpet. So I played the trumpet. And maybe I would have kept on playing a trumpet. I thought I broke it. You know, I didn't realize that you had to, you know, use the oil, the valve, you know, the valve with the valves on the trumpet. I didn't realize that. When I got the trumpet, I had it for like 3 months. And I remember one day I couldn't, you know, it wasn't moving.
Yeah.
Right? I'm going,
yeah.
What the hell's going on here? And, I thought I broke it. So I remember bringing it back to the school, you know, and later on I realized when I started, because I started playing trumpet a little bit later, that I didn't break the thing. You know, I just didn't want to cost my dad like $300 at the time, you know. And then drum lessons became available. I had a Mr. Marchman. He taught all the instruments. He was the guy that, I mean, I remember I had a drum pad. It was the, you know, I'm sure you remember these things. It was like this wooden pad with a pad, piece of rubber on it. And I learned to play a 5-stroke roll, a 7-stroke roll, and a 9-stroke roll. And that was it. And then there was a guy, there was a store up the street. My mom got me some lessons there with a guy, and then so on. And, you know, I would take lessons, you know, when we could afford to take lessons. And
yeah. Yeah.
I had to get a paper round. I had to work to take the lessons and stuff like that. But, you know, I wasn't really thinking. I don't even know if I looked at it as a chore, which is like, it was something I wanted to learn, but I still remember, when my teacher, Bill Weichel, I still remember, he brought in a record. He brought in a Terry Reid record, which I think at one time he was going to be he was going to be a singer in Led Zeppelin. And he brought in Led Zeppelin 1, and he had it on the turntable, and we were playing. I just looked, little black Ludwig kit. I remember I was playing a Paiste ride cymbal. It was, you know, I didn't even know that back then. Because we're going back, it was probably like 65. But anyway, I was playing along to like a Led Zeppelin to a record. And, you know, it's like crazy. No headphones or anything. Just trying my best to keep up with Bonzo.
That's how it started. I did the same thing playing. I didn't have like played my stereo really loud in my room and played along to the records. Yeah. No headphones back then, but.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know any better. I mean, it was just primitive. I didn't know any better. And it's just like, we were real garage bands. We went in the garage and, you know, a friend of mine would bring over an amp, and then we would just play. And, you know, kids would come in front on the driveway and watch us play. And you know, I don't know what we sounded like, but sometimes we sounded good. Next thing you know, we move up to another band. And you know, I end up joining a band in high school. And then it just started like, you know, I remember I was about 16 years old, and I was playing in a bar in New Jersey, and I made $300. This is going back like what, 1972. And I was like, holy crap, you know,
wow,
this is what I'm going to do. I found my calling, you know, I had a 6-pack of beer underneath my floor, Tom, and I was making $300 a week to play. We're doing cover songs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Isn't it wild when you go,
it's
like,
crazy.
Wow, I love doing this and I can actually make money doing it. Yeah, I know. It's
totally, you know, and you know, there were girls. It was like, oh my goodness, you know, and I the drinking age just turned 18 and I was, oh my God, you know, I was, they had to drive me and sneak me into the bar. That's how we, you know, it was
great, good stuff. Yeah. But you know what you said, and what you said at the beginning, David, is so key because I'm a few years younger, but we're really from the same generation. And to have those opportunities we had as kids, like playing as teenagers, yeah. like school dances,
yeah,
clubs, bars, you know, like have, because I say this all the time, but there's still gigs out there, but not like it was when we were kids, like
sure
high school kids.
Like it.
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, there's no school dances anymore where 15, 16-year-old kids go out and play in front of their classmates, you know, and.
Yeah. And, I still remember there was a guy. Now you couldn't even do this anymore. There was a bus driver. He was kind of a crazy guy, and he was this African American dude driving the bus. And he used to wear this, like, sometimes he put this chicken hat on, driving the kids around the school. We were like, "What?" And I remember he had a guitar in his bus.
Oh,
and one
wow.
day I couldn't drive, but he asked me, he said, "You know, can you heard I play drums? So can you come play drums for me?" And I remember all we did is like Chuck Berry songs. And we did this gig and he paid me like $50, which $50 back then. I was like, are you kidding me?
Wow.
You know, $50. I couldn't believe I was getting paid to do it. And I remember that, you know, getting, cause he was an adult, you know, and he was like, you got a job to drive kids around. Can't do that anymore. I mean, to like, he asked me to come play with him. So, you know, I remember doing that gig and, I mean, the bands in school. And everything that happened to me, I just feel like I got very lucky. You know, it's just lucked out and been at the right place at the right time. You know, even with the Hooters, you know, getting into Hooters, it's like I was in a band. I was in bands already that were making records, you know, a couple of, you know, radio records and things like that. Got on these compilations. So I was getting around a bit, but I was playing in a bar in New Jersey. And Eric and Rob just did the Baby Grand thing with Rick Marotta, by the way. Marotta played on their record.
Oh, yes. And, you told me this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Never Enough, which is to me, it's like my Asia. I hear that. I'm like, oh, my goodness. I mean, Marotta kills this track. And but I remember they the band broke up and I remember Clive Davis signed them. He dropped them, and then they came out to this bar we were playing, and I thought they were looking for a lead singer, and they said, you know, I was playing drums, and they asked me if I'd come over to their rehearsal place and cut a couple tracks for them because Eric was trying to get into a film. So I remember I cut. There was an animal song, and we did, and then She Kissed Me, and Please Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood was that one of them. There were four songs that I cut with them, and I packed up my drums. You know, because they asked me to cut this studio. I packed up my drawers. I said like three words to them. They said, this weird kid came over, cut these songs. I cut them. I threw them in my car and I left. And Rob said, to this day, he said, you never said anything to us. You just played and you left. They scared the shit out of me, these guys. They scared me to death. I was like, oh my God, what am I? And they both went to Penn, University of Penn. Man, I was lucky to get out of high school. You know, I was like, holy crap, you know, I'm playing with these two guys. And, you know, and I think they, you know, a few weeks later, they called me up and asked me if I'd come, you know, play some of the original songs with them. And that worked out. I was playing with two other guys in a band that Erica would come sit in with once in a while. They end up being the other guitar player and bass player. And that's how we formed, you know.
Wow.
Crazy. Crazy. It was just like.
Yeah. Yeah.
Looking for a singer. They found a crazy drummer.
And that was 1980, David? That was.
Because we started in 80 and I think I told you the story, you know, when I was walking through the parking lot and Eric goes, well, you know, we got a name for the band. Oh yeah. What's the name? He goes, the Hooters. I went, what? How do we tell my friends the Hooters? You know, like, what? These guys like are making records. You know? Cindy Lauper would say the band with the unfortunate name. It's your lot. To this day, but you know,
it stuck, though. It, you know what I mean? It stuck.
It totally, totally. I mean, it looks good in print, you know. But I remember when they asked me, when they told me that, I was just like, oh, man, my friends would be, what's the name of the band? I'm going,
they named a restaurant after you guys. So that's pretty impressive.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, and later on, the restaurant would want us to do we should do promotions together. We're like, no, we're not going to do that. Come on. You know, you can get a jet with the Hooters on it. I'm going to stop. You know?
Yeah, maybe if they licensed one of your songs and paid you guys some real money, that's...
Yeah, you know, yeah. Yeah. They weren't going to do that. I mean, those corporations, yeah. They're all they're going to want to do is, like, wring your neck and whatever they do.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. Man, let's talk about that because, I mean, I'm such a fan of that band, as you know, when I first met you.
Yeah.
1989. I mean, you guys were on tour with Stevie Nicks that summer. Yeah. We'd never met, but I was excited to see you. And the band is, you guys are so great live. I mean, so much energy.
That's our thing. You know, yeah. I mean, to this day, we just play, we love playing together. We all like each other, which, for 44 years, we still get on. And, from day one, I think that's the way it works. You get in there and somehow we all just connected. In a great way. And for us, anytime that we were like even making records, it's like get in the studio Eric and Rob are the main songwriters. You know, we've all had a little piece in helping out with the songs a bit, but those guys are like our Lennon and McCartney, they drive the ship and, they come into the studio and we still like are that band that plugs in and records that way. And it just works for us. And indeed, the eye contact and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, like but I still remember meeting you. I still remember that day because we were out with Stevie and one of my favorite, and another, I saw James Taylor on the Flag Tour. I guess it might have been. It might have been 1976 or something. And I remember thinking it was Russ Kunkel, Leland Sklar, Danny Kuchmar, Waddy Wattel, and of course, James. I forget that Don Grolnick was playing piano. And I never heard it. That was one of those moments where, like, holy cow, man, the drums. And Kunkel was so great. And so the way he played around the drums. And, you know, he was, in the pocket, but he had this, you know, it was almost like he was dancing over the toms. And it just sounded just...
Yeah.
Amazing to me. So when we went out with Stevie that year, having Kunkel on drums, I got to watch him every night, hang with him. It was terrific. But I remember he was playing those black Christy cymbals. And I was playing, Zildjian guy. He said hey, they almost sound as good as Zildjian's. Remember
Russ saying that? I remember.
Did he just say that?
I know. Yeah. We were sitting having dinner, and I think Russ came over. You introduced me to him, I think, at one point. Yeah. And he came and sat with us while we were having dinner and chatted, and he was so nice. And he said something like, I like these because they remind me of my old Zildjian's.
Yeah.
And I went, I could help you with that.
I could. I know. I was wondering, like, hey, man,
that was a great moment. That was
certainly. We haven't forgot that one. That was what is that? That was Great Woods, right? Was that
that's right? Band? Great Woods. That's right. Right outside of Boston. There. It's still there. It's had about five name changes. It's the Xfinity Center now, I think, but it's still there. Yeah,
like everything else, it's like. Yeah. Nothing stays the same as long as that venue's still there. That's great.
Yeah.
I played there a few times. You know, we opened for a lot of bands in the U.S. I mean, you know, we've always had more success in Europe, but in the U.S. we opened for a lot of great bands, and I got to meet a lot of great drummers and become close to Ryan Adams and Mickey and just
I know you and Mickey are very tight. I remember listening to a podcast, your podcast, when you had Mickey on.
Yeah.
And
I
was laughing hysterically, David, the whole people need, I'll put the link in there when I put this up on YouTube because they should check out your podcast. First of all,
fine. You were a guest on my podcast.
I was a guest, but it's my episode wasn't nearly as good as Mickey's. Cause you guys had this thing, man, where it's just hilarious.
Like a comedy show. Nick lost his calling. He could have been. I mean, at one point, I think they were trying to get him for Saturday Night Live to be in the cast. He's that funny.
Oh my goodness!
I mean, so quick. I mean, first of all, the most amazing drummer.
Yeah,
plays, and then he had that mind and the things that would come out of him would be like. Like, I remember once, the late, great Pat Torpy was like, we were doing a gig out on the green, and we were all kind of huddled up there because we were seeing each other, and everybody's talking about, you know, what are you doing? And this guy's, well, I'm shedding. And he's here and like, I'm shedding this. And Mickey goes, I'm tool shedding, you know, like cutting my grass. What are you doing?
He used to talk about his rider mower that he'd go home and just.
Oh, he's crazy about like lawn tools.
Yeah.
That's just loving thing. Doing it. About rakes and shovels. And that's his thing. Gravel. What kind of peat moss is that? You know, that's Mickey.
I got to tell you one quick funny Mickey thing, too. I remember it was like at a NAMM show. Mm. He happened to be there hanging out. We were having lunch at one of the little places there. And they had just, Bryan Adams had just done like a little tour with the Stones. This would have been like the mid or late 90s. Remember that? Oh. They did like a run with the Stones.
Yeah.
And we were talking about Charlie. We're talking about, you know, playing or something. And he said something to the effect of, Bryan Adams, you know, we call the below average white band.
That's the one I was just trying to remember. Not so average white band, right? Yeah. Below average white band.
Below average white band.
That was Mickey. And you know, Mickey, you know, he had an opportunity. I said, so he said, Charlie, I said, did you meet Charlie? He goes, yeah, he came in my room. And I said, well, what'd you say to him? He goes, I couldn't talk to him. I said, like, I was just complete. Like he just couldn't talk to him. He was so like, I was amazed by that. You know,
Mickey said, that's so funny,
which is so kind of cool. You know, he was just so humble. Yeah. Charlie. You know?
I know. And that's Mickey. He's, you know, he's such a, like a, He's outgoing and funny, but he's also very, you could see him being very respectful of Charlie's space or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Oh, Mickey was unbelievable. Like he knew that when I did that tour we did with Bryan Adams was my first sober tour. I mean, before that I was raising a little hell. As you know, I got into some drugs and alcohol for a while and it was like really kicking my ass, but, you know, especially the drug thing. And then when I went on that tour, I got better. I got, you know, you never get quite better, but I remember going on that tour. Mickey's brother had a similar situation, George. So Mickey embraced me and I met his whole family and, you know, they were great. And they would even, when we would do gigs, I think we were playing at Toad's Place, his whole family came out to the show. You know, it was amazing. He wasn't even playing, you know.
Wow.
He became really supportive. You know, it was like, Dave's playing, so we're going to come support him. It was incredible. Not just because Mickey, they were like, you know, Mickey, that came from somewhere, you know, his folks were wonderful. And his late great brother, George, was fantastic as well.
Oh, that's, I never met him, but whenever I talk to you and we talk about Mickey, it reminds me, I need to reach out to the guy and I haven't spoken with him in a while. So,
He didn't go on tour. I was shocked to see that, you know, that he didn't want to go out this year, but hey, you know, he's been out forever and it was time for him to take a break a bit. And I get it. I totally get that.
I get that.
Get a little beat up out there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, man. Well, let's, you know, just, you know, I have so many things I want to talk about and, you know, we'll
God, I'm really ADD. We're going to be all over the place.
No, it's okay. It's okay. But I want to spend a little more time talking about the Hooters. Cause I think most people watching this, of course, associate you with that band and the success and all the years you guys have been together. And again, I think of you guys as being around like at the, you know, the first record came out in 85, right? 85, 86.
That was our first major record, Nervous Night. We did an independent record in 83 after they did this Cyndi Lauper's record. Rob wrote Time After Time.
Yeah, that's right.
Cyndi,
yeah.
And those Rob and Eric played all over the record. Rick produced it, but those guys helped them in a great way. When they finished that record, which took them about 6 or 7 months, they called me up and said they want to put the band back together. And a couple other guys we recruited to join the band. And they made an independent record. Independent record called Amore. And it sold like over 100,000 copies. We were playing all the time.
Fantastic.
For an independent record without any kind of label. We got distribution, but it did amazing, you know, in the area, Philadelphia, Washington, some in Boston, because we used to come up there and play, but it did really well for us. And then we got signed to Columbia. You know, it didn't hurt that Rob wrote Time After Time and those kinds of things happened. So they signed us in 85. We made that record Nervous Night, which I didn't think, honestly, I was, I was nervous whether or not I was going to play on that record because Anton was doing everything.
Yeah.
When I was like, when we come to a record plan, you know, he was playing on everything. And, I'm pretty sure that if I didn't have a great day when I came in to cut that, those, you know, I remember those four tracks that I cut the first day on that record. they would have become, Mr. Fig, can you come over, please? You know, because he stopped and he came to hear it and he really loved it. So that was pretty intimidating at the same time.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I got to think, who am I to say this, but having the drummer in the band who incidentally can play his butt off.
Yeah.
Chemistry of having all that. You're right. Anton is Anton. I mean, he's a great, solid guy that can come in. But I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm not surprised in the least that.
I didn't know that though. I was, you know, at the time I didn't know. I was like, well, because I'd hear records and I made records. I was making records, but I, not on that level. It changed. Everything changed. You know, we got up there, the Record Plant Studio B, that famous room, you know, we had Bill Whitman engineering, Rick producing. I just felt like, it just felt a little more like I had a little more pressure, you know, although I was accepting fact if I didn't cut it, then. Because those things happened a lot back then.
Yeah,
and it, fortunately, it worked out.
A lot.
And that was that day, I think I recorded And We Danced, Day by Day, Where Do the Children Go? And there was another song from that album that I cut all the same day.
Wow.
Crazy. Yeah, they were all became hit songs.
You know, And We Danced, I love that song. I've been listening to it knowing we're going to have this show today. And I've like revisited because I, you know, it was on the radio nonstop, MTV too. I want to talk about the impact that MTV had on you guys. Just, I mean, it had to have been a huge, because they played that video so much and All You Zombies. And you know, all those
funny stories about that, even making the videos, like All You Zombies is the first time, like that whole medium was a whole new, that was a different ball game. And we got a budget to make a video. They flew us to England, All You Zombies. We were already recording. It was on the independent record and in a different version. It was faster and more of a ska thing. On the Columbia release, Rick wanted to slow it down a little bit and he had us listen to some Pink Floyd stuff. So even the bridge and the solo, we kind of made it more like a bigger wall of sound kind of thing. But, when we did the video, they hired Donald Cammell, the guy that did the movie Performance for Mick Jagger. Yeah. And, we did it in a pumping station, a water pumping station on the Thames River. And if you ever see the video, I'm on this thing that is lowered, I don't know what you call it, like a stage with these chains coming down. It's being lowered from one level to the bottom. And initially he wanted me to play, no offense, because I know you were at Simmons, but he wanted me to play a Simmons kit. I said, no way, buddy. And we really had a moment there. He's like, no, I can just see it. And I said, for some reason, I was just saying, you know, I play an acoustic kit. Can we just get like a four piece, like Ringo kit up there? Trust me, I think it'll work. Thank goodness, because if we saw me coming to that video that day and I'd be sitting around a couple of tiles, I'd be, you know, it was the time.
Yeah.
I wasn't going for it, you know.
But it's interesting you say that because that was such a, like a image back then too, was like, even if the record was recorded on acoustic drums, they'd put Simmons pads in the videos because it was like the hip trendy thing.
Yeah, it definitely more of a thing. I don't know. I just wanted to play an acoustic kit. Maybe I was one of the hide behind there, you know. I didn't want like jumping around and stuff, but at the same time, it was, I remember that was the only time I really made a fuss about anything. Give me a real kit, will you?
That's great. I'm glad you did. And so let me ask you, David, all you zombies, that is, the bass drum on that is that like a sampled bass drum or is that an acoustic bass drum that's?
Well, interestingly, about that track, actually, we cut that in pieces. The original, if you hear the original, it's the same beat. We just slowed it down, and it's a bass drum. It's playing the bass drum. And the cross stick I did, you know, I'm doing the cross stick. I overdubbed that, and I did the hi-hat because there's that, you'll hear the Roger Lynn machines going, you hear that little sound. It's like a sequence thing over that, and I'm playing this like, I basically stole the drum beat from Linton Kwesi Johnson, who was a reggae guy. It was kind of like a Sly Dunbar beat where you're just playing a backbeat.
It's a great beat, man.
Wow. Yeah, it was great. And it worked great with the bridge too, because when I recorded that, I recorded it in pieces. And then, except for the solo in the bridge, because then it kind of turns into like a halftime feel that I play through that, but I cut that with the whole kit. And the other one, I just cut in pieces, you know, and then I overdubbed the, I had to figure out what I was doing live with it and then overdub it with the snare drum, where I took the bottom off the snare and tweaked it up real, you know, real high, and then used that. And people say, oh, that timbale. It wasn't a timbale. It was just a snare without the bottom head on it.
Oh, wow, man.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
But that's, so that bass drum is an acoustic bass drum that's just, it just reverbed and
mm-hmm. Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
what,
that's
a sound,
it.
Man.
It, yeah.
What a sound, man.
Yeah, Bill Whitman, man. Bill Whitman was just terrific. There were a couple different engineers on that, but Bill Whitman and the great John Anyelid, he actually, when we decided that it needed a solo and a bridge, I went back, you know, and, you know, it's different than Pro Tools back in those days. He had to cut the tape, and I had to go cut it, and when they, you know, put the tape back together, and I had to, you know, I had to overdub that, and we put the click on, and I just cut it.
I was just going to say, because with the Lin, with it, you had to play to a click. Obviously, you had to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you have much experience at that point? Or
no? Do a click track? No.
Yeah.
I mean, I do it all. It's funny. I do it all the time. Even with the Hooters, I do it live these days. They like everything so consistently. Our shows, about 95% of that show is all to a click, and on which I run off my SPD SX. But back then. When I heard that click, it was again another, you know, it was a bit intimidating because I was just always playing music and then put the click up and two bars and you were in, you know, that's, and I had to get used to it real quick.
Yeah. But you got to have some good body, you know, like, you know, internal clock chops to be able to just, you know, that quickly.
I always played on top of it though. That was all, even when I listened to those old recordings, like those days, you know, we couldn't go. I remember on the second album when we did Satellite, there's a bass drum now that every time I hear it, I go, if we had Pro Tools, we could have nudged that a little bit. But, you know, everything was, you know, click and we're hearing it, you know. I remember the first time I used a Russian Dragon, I could really see, and I was at Arden, I could see how, you know, in certain spots I was pulling behind or, you know, that kind of thing. But that's what makes it feel real. You know, it's different nowadays. We can see those transients and see where you're at. You know, it's all a different story.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, the click was something that we used because we used to do like to have multiple takes of a song. So if they want to move things, they could do it.
Let's play it. Can we play a little bit of that song?
Yeah, sure.
Let's do it, man. This is.
Yeah.
And this is from the. The
Nervous
Columbia
Night.
From Nervous Night, release. So it's going to be there.
This was a cute, the Live Aid story on this one's pretty good.
Yeah, I want to get to Live Aid too after this, for sure. Yeah.
This is my end. My downbeat off of that glitz.
Beautiful groove, man.
It's fun.
Yeah, he's just gonna break him in half.
Man.
It's a fun song to play live. It's
It's got to be.
When we did that at Live Aid, so we were the first rock band to get on stage at Live Aid. And I was the only one wearing in-ears. And I was, sometimes I would wear them, sometimes I wouldn't, because I was beta testing them for Marty Garcia. And that day I just decided, you know, I'm going to put on the ears today, because I sat in front of the, I would set up kind of like on stage left and on the side there. And I knew that with no monitor check, oh, it's going to be dangerous.
Yeah.
So I popped the ears in because I cued off of that gliss. We'll play the gliss, but I wore the ears that day. And Bob Clearmountain was in the truck mixing the show, and he never heard us before. He didn't know anything about All You Zombies. So he had samples for the snare drums for everybody's, for the show. So I start playing the click, and all of a sudden, you know, I heard the story that he's in the truck just going, what the hell is going on? He's like, and he goes, oh my God, the drummer's hitting the cross stick through that thing. Because in the beginning, if you, there are, I think they might have fixed it, but for a while on some YouTube videos, you can hear, you can hear the backbeat of a snare drum playing that, you know?
Oh,
so,
no kidding.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy. But,
oh my gosh, yeah.
We didn't know anything about it, but yeah. And also what I did too is on that crash, on that cymbal crash out of the, on the chorus there, that I did with a mallet and a 20 inch ride cymbal from Zildjian. I hit that and recorded that to give me that. And for a while there, in the '80s, I would use a sample of, I'd have a pad with a sample of a gong in it. That's what I used to do.
I see. Yeah. So you'd play that as, cause it's. And again, I wondered, It sounds so ahead of its time, like in terms of the sonically, like all the things that you were doing in 1985 that people do now, like
all the time.
But it was like, I'm thinking like, man, he was like really ahead of the times with the sampling, you know, the sounds and the
like we were all into that. And I think Rick really was kind of always thinking ahead of the curve, because I remember. I don't think it was on that record, but the following record, I started making samples for him. Like he would come in, like nobody would be there, and he'd be just recording samples of like just different sounds and different beats. I didn't know what he was doing. He said, hey, can you come and play some beats for me? Just play a shuffle and those kinds of things. And he was taking those and, you know, then he would build like rhythms and like loops that we would play to. It was pretty cool, you know?
Yeah.
And Joe the Butcher from Rough House, he was doing that all the time. I mean, I was playing on a lot of that stuff. They were just building loops with it. You know, it was crazy. Cool stuff. But it was, a little ahead of the time.
Really, really great. I mean, your feel on that song, David,
you're
welcome, man. It's
thank
so
you.
Killer. It's just, I mean, talk about In the
Pocket. Dunbar.
It's
like Dunbar, Carlin Barrett.
But listen, you obviously do, because you got to be able to really, like, get in that zone, you know what I mean? Get in that head to play like that, to have it feel so natural like that.
Yeah, it's hard to fake that kind of reggae feel. You either got it or you don't, I think. You know, it's like, you understand how it'd play it, but you have to, I think, you know, if you don't really feel it, you have to, and if you're having trouble with it, I think you need to really like immerse yourself in it also. You can get into it, because it's got to feel natural. It's almost like playing a blues shuffle, but a different thing. You know, like, you know, you're playing the blues, you feel it. In a reggae thing, you know, you gotta feel it. I mean, obviously you can learn it, but it's something that, you know, played best is really knowing what you're doing with that stuff.
Yeah, 100%. No, you said it perfectly, because the sticking is one thing. Like, you know, the sticking, I won't say it's simple, but it's what you're playing, you know, it's obvious what you put, it's the feel. Yeah. It's to have that integrity, you know what I mean?
Well,
That real
thank
authentic.
You. I appreciate that, you know, I appreciate that.
You've
had Andy Newmark on a bunch of times. He's another guy I would listen to, because he played a lot of cross stick, you know, later on, like a lot of recordings I would hear, he would go back from the backbeat to a cross stick, and it just seemed so natural for him. It just seemed like, you know, nothing. And he was good at that too.
Yeah. I mean, he's a lot of those guys like Rick and Andy, like from that era, Russ Kunkel, could move from cross stick to backbeat really comfortably.
Yeah,
Jim Gordon.
Incredible stuff.
Yeah.
Incredible stuff.
Well, I want to play another song from that record.
Yeah. Cool.
You might recognize this song. I love this song. Were all these songs they weren't cut to a click track. They were all cut live. Well, that song.
All of them. All of them were cut. I was cutting to a click.
You were okay.
Yeah, with the band. I mean, we usually so. Well, on Nervous Night, it was when I said with it, Nervous Night was Eric, Rob, and myself in the studio, and we would Eric would come out with his guitar. Roger Litton would turn on, and boom, a couple bars, and we were in. Yeah. That's how it went, you know.
Okay.
Sometimes he'd be teaching me the song. I think if it's, you know, well, I want to hear what you're playing, but
okay, you'll know this song. I think you'll know this song.
Had to stay out of the way on that one, you know. It's, stay out of way and just I remember it just lay it down and stay out of the way and let the song be the song, you know. And I mean the way it you know that with those guys that's yeah. What I try to do. It's like,
well,
I
think you're being very humble, because the way I every time I hear this song and when I first heard it and just listening to it again today. Yeah. Your use of dynamics, it's like a
it's
a masterclass, really. Yeah. The way yeah, absolutely.
You build it,
and you know you bring it down, you build it back up. Now that's Eric playing bass on this song, probably.
Yeah, Eric's a great bass player. Yeah, he played bass.
What a great bass player! Yeah. What a great bass line.
Oh my God, he's incredible on that. And his guitar riff, his riff is that, like, I remember when I was cutting, I remember to this day cutting that. He had that Junior, he's out there near me. We're in Studio B at the record plant. And, you know, there was the click, and I remember the guitar riff was what got me through, you know, because it's consistent. You know, it was almost like a sequence, you know, but he was playing it live. He's such a great player. And then he laid down that bass, you know, I think it was just me, him, and I might have. Yeah, but I just remember him and I cutting that.
His bass part is so tasty and
yeah,
together. But I mean I'll admit this, if it were me playing that song, David, I would want to rush the shit out of it because there's so much excitement in that song.
But when you're feeling the song and you're hearing it and you're hearing the lyrics and you're hearing what's going on, you know, you might have done exactly what I did. You know, you're feeling and you're getting into the song. I mean, if you allow yourself to hear what's happening there, the music when you're recording and you let it yourself feel it, that's when those dynamics can happen. You know, it's like, you know, it's like I was a fan of their writing. I still am. It's why you guys still got me in the group. You know, it's like, it's great. And listen, they're super cool and they know what I bring to the table, but I'm so grateful that they still are doing stuff and working on stuff like they were back then. I really enjoy it. And the songs are fun to play. They're a lot of fun to play live. I mean, I got to go out. Last year we did like 60 dates. It was a lot of work for us and United States, Europe, and we're going to go out to Europe. We'll do 25 dates in Europe and we play all that stuff live. And we try to bring the same energy we did as we did when we recorded that stuff back in 1985.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah, it's fun.
I'll bet you do.
I got a credit. I was really like Liberty DeVito's a friend of mine. And we go see Lib play with Billy anytime he came to Philly. And I didn't know him at the time, but just the way he would play. I forget what song, Pressure. I remember there was a song. We did a cover of the Arthur Lee and Love song. And I forget the title. It's on our record. But I remember I visualized Liberty, how he would play. And I played it like, I want to play. What would Lib do here? And I want to play it like that. I do that with a lot of drummers. I go, okay, I want to be me, but I really like what he ripped on.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know what you mean. Sometimes you put yourself in, like, how would, you know, in this guy's head. And it's got to be so much fun to play those songs because the crowd must go out of their minds when they hear those songs.
Yeah, they do. They love that song. And it all, the Nervous Night, that's like the gift that keeps giving. Yeah, that record. I love being able to play that. And we have fun doing it. And it's part of our set every time we play. Last week, we were doing that kind of 80s show on Palm Springs. I think I told you it's Smithereens, Berlin, and us, we played. And a lot of that stuff that we were doing in our set was from Nervous Night.
Yeah.
Sometimes we do a different set. We play those songs in Europe, but we had other songs that were hit records over in Europe that didn't do anything in America.
Yeah. Isn't that funny?
You get arrested with it.
But it's nice to be able to do that, to go to Europe and play like maybe the stuff that you're not playing all the time here.
I had to learn German, for God's sake, Johnny. Spent some time over there. I had to like learn how to order a cup of coffee, go to find a bathroom.
So funny. Well, let's take a few minutes and talk about In the Pocket, this other project that you have. That's really, it looks to be a really cool and exciting project. You're paying homage to all these great bands from Philly. So how did that get started?
Well, as you know, when I was living out on the West Coast, I moved down to San Diego and I just kind of got lucky. I was doing a session for an attorney there that was working for a company called MP3.com. And you know, they needed somebody to help them manage the music there. I didn't know anything. I couldn't even open up a laptop back then, you know, barely. Like, you know, I had a website, but it was static. I would show it to people. And I ended up going to work for this company and I learned a bit about technology and, you know, operating systems and things like that. And we were managing music that was, you know, later on would be streamed and downloaded and things like that. But I used to have a little e-zine they used to call Essential Songs of Rock and Pop. There were two different, you know, genres that I would find the music because only about 1% of the music that came in there was good. You know, the rest was pretty horrible. Mm-hmm. After I left there, I was working with a guy named Guy Eckstein, Billy Eckstein's the great jazz singer, his son Guy Eckstein, drummer. He was handling the jazz. I was doing the rock and pop. He said, you got to call your thing In the Pocket because you're the drummer and you play In the Pocket. Mm-hmm. So I took the name. I, you know, when I moved back to Philly and, my wife and I were taking a walk from Rittenhouse Square one day in Philadelphia, from moving from Philly and coming back after 20 years, the city made a drastic change in just the whole vibe of it. You know, it just was a different place. And I loved it so much. And I started thinking about the kind of music that came out of there. And I just started thinking of a project. And my wife said, why don't you start recording songs? And, you know, so I had some friends with studios and I reached out to them. And I, you know, I basically, because the MP3 and digital music was, you know, exploding, we were missing that, you know, that aspect of picking up a record and reading liner notes, and knowing who played on the song and who engineered the song. I love that kind of stuff. So every track that we recorded of our tribute to Philly songs, I did a video where we would talk about the song, talk about, you know, just any kind of information we got to inform people, you know, that like to know more about why the song was made. And basically, you know, I've been doing this for, I think we're coming up on 15 years. We've recorded like coming up on 24 tracks. And we not only record rock songs, but I pay homage to, you know, Philly International. People, I don't know if people know, but Disco Inferno was recorded at Sigma Sound with the Tramps and Earl Young, the great Earl Young. And so I could talk about these guys in these videos. One I think I sent you is the great OJs. They had this great song called Backstabbers that we recorded with my good friend Richie and Charlie. Richie, rest in peace. Him and Charlie from the Soul Survivors, who does a song called Expressway.
Love I grabbed that song.
Sing the track. Yeah, Expressway to Your Heart. Great song. So they came and sang. So I basically record with musicians that I normally don't get to work with. I bring them in the studio and we find a song to do. And Backstabbers is one of them that we recorded. That's one of the ITP songs.
And is it you on drums?
I'm playing drums, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a video for it. There's a video for it, and there's a little bit of mini history lesson. If you go to songsinthepocket.org, you can see there's a little history lesson on the song and the OJs and Richie and Charlie. I do the project. I mean, we not only have that song, but we did Punk Rock Girl by the Dead Milkmen. We honored Young Americans because David Bowie recorded Young Americans at Sigma Sound in 1973. And it was like a big thing in Philadelphia that Bowie was. You know?
I think Andy Newmark's on that song too, right?
I believe so.
I think so.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Well, I'm going to play this song. I love the OJs. I was so psyched when you sent this to me.
Oh, cool. I like this version.
Yeah. And what a great faithful version you guys did too. Yeah. Man. This is killer. Yeah. Here we go.
Check it out.
they do it. All the time they want to take your place with backstabbers. I keep getting all these visits from my friends. Yeah, what they do to me. They come to my house again, again and again and again. So I'll be there to see my woman. I don't even be home, but they just keep on coming. What can I do to get on the right track? Wish they'd take some of these knives out my back. What they do?
That was a fun session. That was another one who was set up live in the room and cut it. You could see that on the, at the website. It was great. Classic songs.
Oh, yeah. Man. Yeah. I'll put the link in there for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just recorded a new one. I there's a, there, we had a, I thought, you know, when I was a kid, I thought if you heard it on the radio here, it was big everywhere. There was an artist out of actually he was from Jersey. His name was Billy Horner. They used to call him the human percolator. 1968 had a song called Sally Saying Something. And so I've always loved the song, but I, you know, it was like a hit, I guess, in areas, regional parts of America. So that's my latest, that's our latest one. I have a horn section. And I brought in Adam Wiener, who's the singer in a band called Loca Connie. He's singing it. He's like the human, the new version of the human percolator. This dude.
what an awesome project. You must be having
fun.
A blast, man.
Yeah, I have fun doing it. You know, I wish I could do it more, but hey, I'm glad that people, friends of mine still want to participate in it. And you know, I have friends of mine with recording studios that, you know, bring us in and we have a blast. Yeah. It's great. It's absolutely great.
That's great. Stuff. And it's, I think it's so great what you're doing too, to like keep that music, you know, I mean, keeping it, it's out there, but you're keeping it in the present day, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was interesting. That was a part of the project that I found that, something later that there were people that didn't know the history of certain songs. And, I thought that was really, really good that we could share that with people. And there were younger people that were hearing it and digging it. Yeah, it was really a lot of fun to do. I love being involved with it and driving it. It's great.
That's great.
I'm like the leader of that band. It's great.
You know, obviously you have the passion for it, but like you have all the knowledge too. You know, you're like an encyclopedia of all this stuff.
Well, you know, that's the one thing that comes along with, and thank you, by the way. One of the things about, you know, experience, you know, And I love to read and I love history and I love finding out about other musicians and of course watching what's happening now with new music and bands that are coming up, you know, so it's like, but the history of music and certainly in where I grew up around here, there's so much and, you know, sometimes I'm still surprised, you know, there was a guy that had a dance TV show named Jerry Blavitt. That was here that when Todd There's a little Philadelphia Walk of Fame thing that they have here that Todd Rundgren was, he inducted us into that. And he was talking about how all he listened to back in the day was Jerry Blavitt. You know, that's how he got his, like his thing. You know, it's something that because I had an opportunity, to do because of the Hooters, I figured, hey, you know, put my time into a good project. So that's, it's been great, a lot of fun. Yeah, it's been great.
You know, I mean, and there's, Philly is so rich with music history too. You know, I mean, there really is a Philly sound. It's a real thing. And
you
guys are blessed to have that, you know?
Totally, totally. And it's funny, my Rob Hyman, who's the keyboard player, writes a lot of songs with the Hooters. He has a studio, that's like 5 minutes from where I live. And then there's Studio 4, which is great. They used to all be down in the city, but everything's kind of moved out to the suburbs, and there's fewer and fewer places like that these days. You know, everything's at home. I mean, I got a studio downstairs that I work out of, you know, but I always like when I get a chance to go to an actual recording studio, I'm like, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
How about, like, I'm reading the Jim Gordon book. I'm reading that right now.
You are. Yeah. It's pretty heavy, isn't it? It's, yeah.
You know, those days were, you know, amazing. And, his story is remarkable. And it's like, you are providing such an amazing, a service for everybody. I mean, it's really great, Johnny, that you were having these authors come on here and talk about that. You know, I know you had Robin on, you know, talking about Jeff. And who I never had a chance to meet. I would have loved to meet him. I just moved to LA at the time. And, you know, you had Joel on there. That was amazing. I mean, this is stuff that a lot of drummers need to know these. I mean, I
know
the history
mentioning
where they come from. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for mentioning both of those authors and those books. And speaking of Robin, you know, she has a new book out. Jeff Porcaro's stories, and I have a copy of it.
Great.
It's going to be on the show. I think we're going to do the show on April 1st.
Fantastic.
Which would have been Jeff's 70th birthday.
Wow.
So when I mentioned it to Robin, she loved the idea, and I think it's going to work for our schedule. So we'll give a little sneak, you know, shout out on that one that Robin Flans will be returning. So.
Oh, that'd be great. And I know you're very close with Simon Phillips too. You know, I mean, I got to know him a bit from touring around over the years, and with the Hooters have done shows with Toto. So he's always a guy that I've like had dinner with and hung out with, and what a sweet human being that guy.
He really is. He's the greatest. You know, we sometimes don't talk to each other for a couple of months, and we just missed each other in London a few months back, but you know, we sort of pick it right up where we left off, you know, and it's always, Simon's always like, so when are we going to have dinner together? Like, when is that going to happen? When are you coming to LA? And it's like, oh, I'm not coming to LA anytime soon. But he's such a
bit of a foodie, isn't he?
He is.
How's he not walking around like this? You know,
I know. It's because it's the way he plays. He's such a physical drummer.
Oh my goodness, man.
I know. But, you know, speaking of that, I mentioned the other day when we were talking, I remember in 1989 also when I first met you that summer with the Hooters. And then a couple of months later, I was in L.A. for the Buddy Rich Memorial Concert that Zildjian produced. And yeah, we had the big show was at the Wiltern Theater, October of 89. Yeah. And then we're having the after party at the Hyatt on Sunset. And I bumped into you, who were staying there, right, at the hotel?
Yeah. Yeah, I think I just moved to L.A.
Oh, okay.
And I remember, I can't remember, I usually that's where we stayed, but I ran into you and then you introduced me to Steve, which was like meeting, you know, it's like meeting God, you know, oh my goodness. And he was such a sweetheart of a guy, you know, and his life like was just, you know, just going that way and he was doing great. So that was, I'll never forget that.
Oh, well, that was
to a lot of guys. Myron became my neighbor later. I moved to Woodland Hills and he introduced me to all those guys at that Woodland Hills Drum Club. I met a bunch of guys there. They were always so great.
That's what Myron does. Yeah. He welcomes you to the neighborhood, to the family.
Yeah. He lived very close to me. So, and he was a great guy, introduced me to a bunch of people. And we just, you know, every time I seen him, it's Tyrone. He was so
Tyrone. Yeah. He's the best. Myron Brownbacher. I know. I remember I was just getting to know Steve at that time, Steve Gadd we're talking about. And I remember, you know, being in that room and we'd spent like a week out there like rehearsals and all that stuff for it. And you know, like you were, and like, I think everybody that meets him for the first time, I've met him a long time before that, but, and I realized just how incredibly down to earth and sweet and humble he is. And he'd be, you know, he'd come over to me and say like, how does it sound? Does that sound okay? Or, you know, like, I'm like, you're asking me how it sounds or how the drums sound, you know? Yeah. And then of course we went on to become great friends. And
that blows me away that you get that kind of relationship with him. That's fantastic. And I just watch, I don't know if he's still running, but I know that, you know, like I'm having my knee scoped and I have a torn meniscus and I had to have a hip replacement, and like drumming, like it, you know, and it's all the playing. It's not because I play football. It was like playing the drums, you know, and I remember when I was seeing him, he was running a lot, which blew me away because it was a few years, not that long.
He still does. I think not as much, but he still does get out. Yeah, it does. Absolutely.
But you got to keep your heart going. You have to, you know, I try to get to, you know, take care of myself so I can, like last week when I played that gig, I only had to play for an hour. We had some issues on stage, monitors. We use in ears and it wasn't sounding like it should. But it's a couple of times I'm there like, oh, holy cow, you know, and we dance and we die, you know, it's like that kind of stuff is a little bit of work, you know. So
it's a physical instrument, and you know, certainly make it physical too. I've seen.
Well, and also, they want me to play a drum solo every night, which is, what did I get myself into? I don't know this. Like what?
It's great. People love it. Yeah.
The show must go on, and they're the bosses. They say, can you do that? I said, well, I'll try. And I thought they were like, oh, this is really bad. And they go, we're going to put it in the set. I keep on trying to say, well, you want to put something else? I said, no, this is your drum part. You're going to go. Gosh, stop already. You're going to try. I think they're trying to kill me.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, man, this has been so great.
It's been fun. Absolutely, Johnny. Yeah, thank you. I when I saw that email come from you, I was like, wow, because I love what you're doing, and I know how hard it is to do this. So we'll chat about it. It's a difficult thing to put it all together and all the prep work. I hope your friends know how hard you work to put this together to bring us such joy. It's awesome.
Thank you, David. Awesome. Man, you make it really easy. I mean, this has been so fun, and I've been so looking forward and so overdue in having you too. So,
well, thank you. Anytime, man. It was a gas, man. It was a lot of fun.
And good luck with the surgery and
thank you.
Rest up after that. And we'll stay in touch. And in the meantime, well, thank everybody for watching and listening. Yeah. Big hand for David Wasikinen.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
And
thank you.
We'll see you all soon.
All right, man. Bye-bye.
All right, well, that's my show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, give it a like, leave me a comment. Don't forget to subscribe to my YouTube channel if you haven't done that already. And the podcast is available on all the podcast platforms, so download it. And remember, no drummers are ever harmed on Live From My Drum Room or Track Talk. And drummers, when in doubt, leave it out. All right, again, thanks for watching, thanks for listening, and I'll see you again real soon. See ya.